Welcome to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm glad to have you with us today. We have an interesting show today. I'm going to be talking with John Grobe. He is an expert in getting a job, keeping a job, but today's emphasis is on career transition. It's a career transition guide for federal employees. And as we all know, the retirement tsunami, which has been predicted for the last decade or so, finally seems to be with us. The retirement projections are up almost every month. OPM's doing a good job with its backlog. But with all the buyouts and normal retirements, the pipeline is getting crowded. And so we can anticipate that a lot of you who are listening right now, who are happy in your jobs, may be transitioning into the private sector in the next few months. And it's easier said than done. I know doing what I do, people are always asking me, how do you get a federal job? And I have to confess, I don't have a clue. I've never helped anyone. None of my kids got federal jobs. And then this idea of career transitioning, I've done that a couple of times, but it is easier said than done. So my guest today is John Grobe. John, thank you for coming all the way from Minnesota.
Illinois,
okay.
Still in the Big Ten.
Long way, okay. Very good. And your book is called Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. What's your background, John?
Well, my background, I spent 26 years in the federal government in various human resource and union positions. And about 15 to 16 years ago, I went through my own career transition. I took an early out and a buyout from the Department of Treasury and started my own business. My specialties are in two areas, retirement, pre-retirement seminars and so on, and career transition, assisting employees in making the decisions necessary to have an effective transition outside of the federal government. For a while, I spent some time working with a private sector outplacement firm dealing with that question you referenced earlier. How do I get a federal job? So I've kind of worked both sides of the job search street.
Okay, well, in looking through your book here, I thought I would earmark some of the interesting pages and chapters, and I wound up folding almost every other one, every other thing here. When you start out of this book, what do you, you start out by telling people, A, do you want to leave your job, correct?
Correct. It starts out a little more on the soft side. It doesn't start out talking about resumes or interviews or anything like that. It talks about what is a transition, what are the stages of a transition, and then we go through some processes. I have some checklists. Should I stay with the federal government or should I go? What are the various pros and cons?
I thought that was interesting because your home state guy, Abraham Lincoln, apparently this is one of the things he did in making a decision. He would write a legal brief for and against something and then weigh it. And you've literally got a checklist in your book that people say, how much do I value this? And you talk about things like health insurance and retirement and that kind of thing.
Yes, I do. Coming from an agency that dealt with accounting, I prefer to think of it as a T account where you put your debits and credits, as it were. But yes, absolutely. The federal government has benefits that are very hard to beat in the private sector. So that is something someone has to look at versus the other parts of a transition. What is it they want to do? Do they have that proverbial boss from hell? Is their agency reorganizing and shutting down an office or moving a certain category of job from Pittsburgh to Oklahoma City? So lots of different ways to look at it. But benefits, I think, come down on the side of the government.
I would think so. I noticed one page here you say reason. You've got a chart that says reason, and then it says stay, leave, why. And it's job security, pressure or stress, retirement benefits, other federal benefits, leave, health insurance, higher pay, opportunity, risk, expanding your career. So, certainly in the benefits area, you can argue about pay, but in the benefits area, the government would be the clear winner. So why would anybody leave?
Well, I think federal benefits are under unprecedented attack now, and some employees might be considering, pardon the expression, pulling the plug before some adverse changes are implemented. Now, I have my own opinions on whether adverse changes will be implemented, but that certainly is something that's driving the thinking of some employees. Gee, maybe I better get out of here before they throw a high five at me, or before I go through umpteen years of salary freeze, or so on.
Tammy Flanagan, who does the benefits coordinator, she's well known in the field. She's with the National Institute of Transition Planning. And before many of her classes, I've seen her do a number of them, but before many of her classes, she brings out a letter that the Air Force sent out to its civilian employees. And it says, the following changes are about to be made. We will advise you when it's official, but here's what's coming and here's what they look like. And one of them is changing the retirement formula from the highest three-year average salary to the high five. And that seems to be the one most people focus on. But there's also a voucher plan for health insurance, the chained COLA, the CPI, changing that formula. About seven or eight of these, what we call now the usual suspects, that come up all the time. And then she shows them the letter, and it's dated 1991.
Wow.
So this has been, this monster has been on the horizon for at least since the 1970s and through the 80s, and I recall doing it. And in the news business here, we get, I won't say tired of it, but we think, are we hyping this? Because it comes up every year, we come to the brink, and then it seems to go away. The Simpson-Bowles Commission recommended a number of these things. The Congressional Caucus Group did it. The Vice President Biden's Blair House Group made these recommendations. Nothing happened. So I personally, if somebody was going to leave government because they were afraid something might happen, I don't think that's a very good reason.
I have to agree with you with that, Mike, because the first time I heard about a high five, my hair, which the audience can't see, but you can see, is pure white, was dark brown.
Yeah.
It was in the 1970s I first heard that rumor. I don't think we've ever seen as many threats being talked about as loudly as they are now, but I do believe we have to still consider them as threats. Someone might pick up the book on career transition to get a jump start in case something happened and they might want to consider a transition. I also believe that the government, if they were to implement, let me pick the high five as an example, would be inclined to do serious grandfathering.
Yeah,
I'm sure out in the audience there are CSRS people listening. Why are they still in CSRS? 25 or so years ago, they were grandfathered into the old system. I could see serious grandfathering going on if they went to changes like the high five.
Yeah, that's something that, and I think your point is well taken, is that when people seize on one threat, and it is just that, it's a threat, and then they start building deciding to fold up their career and move on to another job, that is not a good reason to leave your job.
Correct. I don't think we should engage in panic. A little preparation can help, though, in the event a person thinks a transition might be in the future. There's an old saying, success is where preparation and opportunity meet. We don't have a clue when the next opportunity will present itself, but we do have a lot of ability to prepare ourselves for when it does happen.
Okay, I'm going to take a short break here. I'm talking with John Grove about his career transition book. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Your Turn. This is Mike Causey. I'm talking with John Grobe. He is a specialist in getting a job, keeping a job, and transitioning to a job. And this is particularly of interest for federal workers now because so many people are at retirement age, the normal retirement age, and the number of retirements has been picking up each month. So a lot of people are going to want to go out into the world, and many people for either for tactical reasons or for financial reasons want to keep working. Maybe a different field, but they want to keep working. And John's book, which is called, by the way, Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees, has a financial decision checklist. And just before the break, I'd ask him about it and kind of run down that checklist.
Okay. A lot of the items that are in this checklist are covered in more depth in a couple of the following chapters, Chapter 4 on actually retiring from the federal government, and Chapter 5, what happens to benefits if you leave before retirement. But for example, with health insurance, an individual who is retiring certainly has the opportunity to carry their FEHB into retirement as long as they have been enrolled either on their own or as a family member on their federally insured spouse's account for the 5 years immediately preceding retirement.
The all-important five-year rule, yeah.
Yes. And also, someone who leaves before retirement would be entitled to 18 months of temporary continuation of coverage. That's called COBRA in the private sector. An individual who was leaving before retirement might end up being carried on their spouse's health insurance. You would be surprised when I do retirement seminars and ask how many people are married to another federal employee, especially if I ask that question in D.C.
Yeah.
The hands go up. Often a third of a class is married to another Fed. There might be other opportunities, group insurance. For example, if I'm a certified public accountant and I am leaving my federal job before retirement and my new employer does not offer health insurance, I might be able to get insurance through a professional organization like AICPA. I might carry a private policy, although that would be rather expensive. And of course, I could always do nothing and play the health insurance lottery. That's probably a wiser bet for a young person than for someone near the end of their career.
Okay, and this you mentioned too here, the thrift savings plan. The options are leave the money in the TSP, roll it over, transfer it to an IRA, take it in a lump sum, take it as equal monthly payments, or to annuitize it. Do you have any recommendations for that, or does it depend?
I think it depends to a large extent. If you look at the pros and cons of leaving it in versus rolling it over, for example, that might be the first step someone makes. If I leave my money in the TSP, the odds are really good that I am going to have lower expenses than I will anywhere else. The TSP has incredibly low expenses. And if I am leaving because I'm retiring and I am at least in the year in which I turn 55, I will have no early withdrawal penalty taking money out of the TSP. But if I roll it into an IRA, I am governed by the IRA's 59 and one-half rule. However, if I put the money in an IRA, I will have a greater variety of investments. This assumes, of course, I know something about investing, but perhaps I want to have more investment choices. Right now, we don't have that in the TSP. If I wanted to invest in a mutual fund in the energy industry or the automotive industry, if I wanted to invest in an individual stock, I could choose to do that within an IRA. And I think one thing that's important, if people are thinking of drawing their money from the TSP at the time they leave, an IRA gives more flexibility in withdrawal options than does the TSP. So there's lots of different pros and cons, and it depends on where an individual is, which one would make the most sense for them.
Right. A number of people over the years have asked the TSP to increase its investment options, and the TSP argument and the board that runs it includes unions and professional groups. They agree that they say the S&P 500 covers the 500 largest companies. The other fund covers all the rest of the stock market, and you have an international fund and a bond and a stock fund, and they say you've got all of these things in it without the risk. And I remember And you, I think the last time you and I were doing a show together a decade ago, the big push was for REITs, real estate investment trusts, and they couldn't lose. It didn't matter what happened to the housing market, they couldn't lose, and there was tremendous pressure put on Congress by the industry and on those of us in the media that covered this to set up a REIT for the federal program. And as it turned out, that would have been disastrous because it did affect the housing market, did affect REITs as well. There have also been people who've advocated precious metal funds, gold in particular, but platinum and uranium. And again, the cooler heads at the Thrift Savings Plan say, look, you've got enough choices. If you want to do this, do it on your own, but continue to diversify.
One of the latest pushes is for socially responsible investment funds. That's another push that's been going on. And the TSP board has been given the authority to offer mutual funds within the TSP. They were given that authority perhaps 3 or 4 years ago, and they made a point at the time they were given that authority to say, we do not intend to exercise this authority. So, yes, the TSP is broader-based index funds, and for people who are not following investments or the markets, that might very well be the best way to go. We have had also the life cycle fund since 2005, where the thrift board will adjust the proportion of savings, gradually moving. I think the L2050 fund at the beginning of this year had 3-point-some percent sitting in the G fund. But by the time that fund transitions over decades into the L income fund, you're looking at 74% in that G fund. So we have some more options in the thrift.
It grows more conservative for you, and it does it on automatic pilot. Yeah, the life cycle funds are slowly but surely getting very popular with people. And I have a friend who is in the life cycle fund, but he thinks the fund for his age is too conservative. So instead of being in the 2020 fund, which most people would recommend, he's in the 2030. So it's slightly more aggressive and more, let the cards roll where they may.
That's the beauty of the L funds, too. They don't ask for ID when you sign up for them. They don't look at your birthday and tell you you can't get in that fund.
And you mentioned the low fees of the Thrift Savings Plan. We'll get off that. But it just reminded me, I interviewed John Bogle on this very show one time. He is the founder of Vanguard and the godfather and the grandfather of index funds. And Vanguard had the lowest administrative fees in the business. And John Bogle said he would love to get into the federal thrift savings plan. He wished there was a way he could get into it because of its low fees and the things it offered. And Alan Roth of CBS Money Watch said the same thing. He's looking for a way to get into the TSP. So if anybody's leaving the government and they want to play with their TSP money, it's fine to put it into an IRA and go rock and roll. But also some of the leading financial experts in the country say you can't beat the TSP.
I think that's generally true, although if you were looking at focusing your investments more, you don't have the opportunity to do that in the thrift. There are definitely pros and cons here. Another thing an individual could do, if I'm leaving federal government to go work for a private sector concern and they have a 401k, I could roll my thrift plan into the 401k. Or conversely, if I keep my money in the thrift plan and participate in a 401k with a new employer, once I leave that job with the new employer, as long as I have not begun taking distributions, I'll be able to roll the money from that 401k into my thrift savings plan.
Good deal. Just to take a short break here, I'm talking with John Grobe about his book, A Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Federal News Radio. Mike Causey here. I'm talking with John Grobe. He's written the book, and this is not your first, Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. And we were talking about the TSP when we took a break. But you have a very interesting section in here that I think I'm not sure I've ever seen it before in a retirement transition advice. And it's talking about family issues. What do you mean by that?
Well, we are not islands. Most of us have families. We might have a spouse or partner. We might have children of various ages, might have, disabled relatives. So there are others who will be affected by our decision. And in this little family issues section, this is actually something I picked up when I was working in private sector outplacement on a project basis, that an individual leaving should consider the effect of that on their family members. How will their spouse feel? What will the effect be on their children? And of course, that would depend upon the age of the child. A young child wouldn't understand that. I was, I believe, 4 years old when my dad lost the job. Mm. All I knew was he was spending more time with me at home.
were eating less.
if I were a teenager, I might worry, for
very
example,
traumatic.
That, wait a minute, does that mean I'm not going to get to go on vacation? Does that mean they're going to cut my allowance?
Yeah.
Does that mean I'm going to have to get a part-time job or spend more hours on my part-time job? Or, on the other hand, if I am an adult child, I could be a great source of support.
Well, I was lucky. I made a transition. I left the Washington Post after many years. I loved it there, but I literally got an offer I couldn't refuse. And my two sons were adults by then. And in fact, both of them had a lot of experience in job hunting, and they were a tremendous help in talking me into making the change after I'd been somewhere for 25 years. It's a big change, but that was a big help. But I could see where if you do have a teenager and a spouse. Not only are they worried about their allowance, but they may be traumatized for you if you leave the safety of a job that you've known and presumably loved, and that they can read you. They can do that. Okay, you got a chapter here, chapter 3, which I always think is good, is what'll you do? And I've heard the advice from people, they'll say, don't retire from something, retire to something. And I guess that's what you're getting at there.
Absolutely. You want to look at where you are going. You don't want to look at where you have been. If I make a decision because I want to badly be from my current agency, I might have a rougher time getting to where I want to be. I might retire and not know what I want to do. I might not have done my research and retired thinking I could easily find the job in my field, and suddenly I may not find the job in my field. So this chapter on what will you do, it uses a lot of outplacement techniques. Let's look at your values. Let's look at your skills. Let's look at your personality. Let's just see what type of position might fit me. For example, the author a lot of people know, Richard Nelson Bowles, he wrote the What Color Is Your Parachute book. He assumes in writing that book that an individual does not know what they want to do. They only know they want to do something else. So in that book, he has exercises similar, though more detailed than the ones I have in this book, that help a person decide what they are interested in. Not saying you should do this, but saying people who have similar values, skills, and interests have found satisfaction in careers such as these.
I used to work with a guy, and we were almost mirror images within a couple of days of the same age and whatnot. He was much better educated than I was, and he had gone to good schools and all of that sort of thing. But his father sent him $1,000 a month, and back then that was a fortune. That would be like $5,000 now. So this was just a gift that came every month, and as a result, money didn't mean much to him. And when we'd go into union negotiations, he would say, "The issue here isn't money; it's time." And we'd all look around because with us it was money. But he wanted more vacation time because he had the money to spend it on the vacation and eat while he was on vacation. I notice in your value chart here, you've got a 5-point system, and you rank different things: high salary, short commute, meaningful work, working with people, working alone, opportunities for development and advancement, frequent travel, be creative, regular hours, job security, large company, small company, benefits, etc. And that's a very interesting way to look at it. I mean, just sit down and analyze it. And particularly the one that caught my attention was short commute, because in the Washington area now we have arguably the worst and certainly the second worst traffic in the country. And
someone in New York would argue with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, right. But these various surveys do that. I mean, it used to be L.A. too, but now it's D.C. and all of them. And the Tysons Corner area in Northern Virginia is a nightmare. But I know a number of people who have retired, and they now schedule their life around missing the rush hour, which in this area starts very early and ends late, and then starts again and ends late. But that's a major factor, short commute.
Yes, it is. If I was used to commuting an hour and 10, an hour and 15 minutes a day, and an opportunity came up where it was either a short drive or perhaps I could even walk to work, that would make it look really appealing, even if salary might be less or benefits might be less, because it would give me more time to live my life and less time to be behind the wheel of a car or sitting on the metro.
When I left the Washington Post and to go with an internet enterprise, I was at the gym one night, maybe 3 or 4 months after leaving, and I was on the treadmill, and I looked down at my watch, and it was 6 o'clock, and I got off the treadmill to go call the city desk, which I did every night for 20 plus years, and I realized I didn't have to do that anymore. And I thought about the times I'd call, would have to call the city desk if I was in an airplane, if I was in Paris, if I was on the West Coast. I would have to call at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard or Eastern Daylight Time to check on the column and see if any changes or any questions. And once that went away, that was like I picked up 5 years of my life, and it was a lifestyle thing that had never occurred to me as a stressor until I didn't have to do it.
Yeah, I bet you that was mighty empowering.
It really was, and it was months into the thing. You got a section here called Your Interests, and this is interesting. The area is realistic, investigative, artistic, social, enterprising, and conventional. What do you mean by that?
Well, these are based on the work of the psychologist John Holland. He took Jung's theories and put them into specific areas. There are several assessments that will rate a person in which of these areas are the most dominant. For example, if I came out strongly realistic, I might very well be in a job where I work with my hands or perhaps work with data. Investigative, I might be more curious, looking into things. I might be a scientist. Interestingly enough, artistic, the self-expression, drama, music, and writing, that is a high level, at least in the broad base of assessments that are given, for attorneys. I guess you have to be artistic sometimes when you're writing a brief or something like that. But this is in an assessment a lot of people have taken. It's called the Holland Self-Directed Search. They have versions for adults making transitions. They have versions for kids coming out of school that can help a person decide based on interests. Now, just because I'm interested in something doesn't mean I'm any good at it.
I want to be a trapeze artist, right?
Right, or I want to be an opera singer, and I certainly don't have that ability.
Yeah, very good. Okay, I'm going to take a short break here. I'm talking with John Grove about his career transition book. We'll be right back here on Federal News Radio. Welcome back to Federal News Radio, and your turn. This is Mike Causey talking with John Grove. He is a specialist in career transition, finding a job, keeping a job, leaving a job. And this is a really interesting book here, because you're talking about a variety of things, and you have a very small, but I suspect very important, a section here on your personality. What do you mean by that? You're transitioning.
Well, I would want to look at, and a lot of Feds are familiar with what's called the Myers-Briggs type indicator. Yeah. I think in the 1990s, we all had to take this darn thing. But for example, if I score heavily on the so-called introverted scale, I might be a great forest ranger up in that lookout in the wilds of Montana. However, if I were very extroverted and got my strength from people, that wouldn't be a good job. If I were an extroverted outdoors person, I would probably want to be a National Park Service ranger in one of our more popular parks where I could give guided hikes to visitors.
Probably glad I didn't do that early on, because I, with a lady friend one time, we went to counseling, and they tested us, and it came back, and it said that I was at the extreme end of masculine, she was at the extreme end of feminine, and that was causing some clashes there, so clash of culture, if you will. And I remember the lady that gave us the test said, the only saving grace is you're both borderline introverts. So had I taken that test then, I might be a park ranger in Montana instead of here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, personality, now skills. How do you, is it, how difficult is it to honestly assess your skills? Because most people I know say that they could make more money elsewhere. And I heard this constantly from friends at the Washington Post, that they knew they could make more money outside, but they didn't do it. And I sometimes question that.
Yes, we are all above average.
Absolutely. Thank you, Garrison Keillor.
Yeah, and there have been surveys that show 80% of people rate themselves as above average. Well, average is supposed to be 50%. I think unless we are deluding ourselves, at least the skills that we look at in the book, oral communications, written communications, decision making, and so on, we will come up with a relatively accurate assessment. This particular table also asks for examples for those skills. By coming up with examples of how I am a good oral communicator, how I solve problems and so on, that will ultimately help me down the road. There are several chapters in the book dealing with resume writing, interviewing, and so on. And when or if we get to that stage of looking for a job, we need to be able to effectively and articulately tell people what our skills are, what results we have achieved. I can't just say I was responsible for something. I have to say that I managed this program, and during my management of the program, I reduced the backlog of cases. I'm hoping some people at OPM can make that statement. Yes. On their performance reviews soon.
Well, but be realistic. Don't.
I think you have to be realistic, and often when you go through an assessment, if you have a close friend or a close coworker, you might want to ask them to take a look at it. They might find that you are either being too bashful, being too modest. Modesty, yeah, can sometimes negatively affect us in a job search. Or they may suggest that you rated yourself a little high in a couple areas and give you examples of that. Having people reviewing what you're doing is incredibly helpful.
I used to, I always walked to work. I'd park in an area and walk to work. And in the summers, I would walk through this huge hotel in Washington. It's the Shoreham, if you know that area. It's a huge hotel. And I'd go through it in the winter to get some warmth, and in the summer to get into the air conditioning while I was walking. But they frequently had not job fairs there as such, but I guess the vendors were there, and people who make Tupperware and people who do this were there, and they were looking for people to sign on as with franchises. And it struck me as a pretty sad lot for the most part. It was usually a sort of a wizened little old man and his long-suffering wife sitting there, and they were into a seminar, and you could tell that he had been a salary man all his life, as I have been, you know, not an entrepreneur, but you make a salary and somebody pays you. You work for the man, and I think, and of course, government workers are that, and I think many of them have this idea that I'm going to go out and work for myself. I'm going to start up a career, and I know you have a section here, Chapter 7, about working for yourself. yourself. What's that all about? Is that Great Expectations, isn't it?
It explains the pros and the cons. I remember, and this was probably about the time of our last interview, it was a mm-hmm. long time ago, I was doing some outplacement with a federal organization. They were literally shutting one of their offices. And I conducted a seminar on self-employment. I had about 20 people, and I asked them how many were seriously considering self-employment and how many were in just to see if it might appeal to them. Well, a good 15 to 16 hands went up. So I went through all the things you have to do. I could be the greatest, for example, copy editor in the world, but if I did not know how to market my services, if I didn't know how to keep my books, file my taxes, and so on, I might not be successful on my own. I even took them on a field trip to the Small Business Association office. And at the end of the class, when I asked them how many people were considering working for themselves after the class was over, three hands.
16 before
went up.
And three yes. after, yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's very interesting. And you talk about the accounting and the tax part of it, because a lot of people, again, we salarymen, the company takes out our FICA and our federal taxes and whatnot, and then at the end of the year we settle up. But if you're self-employed, you have to do that yourself, and you have to pay, I presume, Social Security for both yourself and as the employer, correct?
Yes, that is correct. You do get a deduction on the employer's part when you file your tax return, but yes, you do. A lot of the things that are done for us while we are working for someone else, we have to do ourselves, and you know, that's why we might hire an accountant. That's yeah. why if we actually start a business where we have people working for us, we hire a payroll provider or something like that. We have to, if I'm just doing a sole proprietorship, I'm going to have to make estimated tax payments more often than not on a quarterly basis.
John, I'm going to ask you, how do people get your book? You have a website or something?
This book is published by the Federal Management Institute, and their website where the book can be ordered, it's relatively easy, all lowercase, federalmanagementinstitute.com. And they can click on publications, and they can find the book, Career Transition, A Guide for Federal Employees. Just to be prepared, I went to their website this morning before I came here to see what they're charging for it. Mm-hmm. Charging $15.95 plus shipping.
Okay, very good. Very good. And I'm looking back here, the average age of the federal workforce today is about 47, 48. As you note in your book, the Age Discrimination and Employment Act protects people 40 and older. And as you point out, you can join AARP at age 50, and you can collect a federal pension at age 50 if you meet certain criteria. So the definition of an older worker is really pretty low there, in you know, mid-40s, certainly age 50. What are the special issues, other than some of the obvious, for an older worker who's looking to transition to another job?
I think an older worker in their resume or application form needs to show current accomplishments, things they have accomplished, results they have achieved recently. I think, if at all possible, an older worker might want to not list the years in which they got their education. With a private sector resume or application, it's not like the old 171 or heaven yeah. forbid the SF-86, where you had to list everything you ever did in your life.
Right.
You go back. Now, there's a rule of thumb of 10 to 15 years, but that it could be more or less, depending. Those are several things you want to do in the interview. You want to be especially ready for the question, where do you see yourself in 10 years?
Uh-huh.
You know, they...
Yeah. You know, with something else you said that really resonated, and fortunately I'd heard this, but somebody once said, when you talk about your accomplishments, cite some very recent excellent examples. I was on a panel one time with several other federal columnists, and they asked one guy, and he was maybe the dean of the community at that time, but they asked him what was his best column, and he said, well, in 1948, and I quickly said my best one was 2 weeks ago, you know, but making it relevant.
A great answer would be the last one I wrote.
Exactly, exactly. This meal is the best. In the very back of the book, I thought I had picked up a dictionary by mistake. It's you have a action words for use in a resume. Starts with accelerated, accepted, accomplished, ends up with visited, volunteered, worked, and wrote. So these are words that'll jump out at somebody looking at your resume.
Well, resume formatting is actually more important than a lot of people think. You want to get up in the beginning of any statement exactly what it is, what action you took, what skill you needed. And these are very common action words. I think every book that it was written about resumes or that had resumes as a part of it is required somehow to have a list of action words in there. And these are simply examples. They certainly won't apply to everyone. But you want to look at actions. You want to make it action-oriented. Even more, you want to make it results-oriented.
Very good. John, thank you. We as usual, we over-talked our time. Had a good. Thank you, John Grove, for coming down. We'll be talking to you again, and we will post the how to get your book on our website. So thank you very much. Thanks for being with us here on Your Turn. We'll see you next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Have a good week.